Guns, Trump, and Presidential Wannabes on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising, with Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president. Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
I have never met with Russians.
Our elected representatives can abuse subordinates and then secretly use a slush fund of our money to pay them off.
Black Lives Matter, the Antifa movement, is interested in preserving the fabric of America.
This is The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com, and welcome back, or welcome aboard if it's your first time around. We've got a lot of guns on the table this week to talk about, both within and without the movement. Some interesting fights going on. We have gun control, really multiple candidates for President of the United States leading with anti-gun announcements, both Kamala Harris and this Swalwell guy. They're proclaiming it like their number one issue is taking guns away from fellow Americans. So we're going to get into that. We're also going to get into Donald Trump at the NRA convention and what I think should have happened there, which was that he should have got a Bronx cheer instead of a standing ovation. And also internal political fights taking place at the NRA, perhaps existential fights regarding the future of that organization. There is a coup a-brewing at the current national convention. Firstly, though, the big news. It looked touch and go at the beginning of the week, but it did happen. Joe Biden formally enters the race for President of the United States. And for a very special segment on the podcast, here's me with Tim Donner to talk about it. Tim Donner, Uprising Joe Biden for President correspondent, fresh from your trip to the Wilmington White House. No,
yes, I love that Wilmington. That's really good. I strained to find something with a D, like Delaware something, but you've come up with it, Wilmington White House. I'm going to run with that.
Well, Tim, I know that you wrote a piece for LibertyNation.com about Joe Biden and his entry into the presidential race. I haven't read it just yet, but I'm assuming that it's consistent with your other high-quality writings, and I recommend it to others, a sight unseen on that basis alone.
It's consistent with my other writing. If you want to use high quality, that's in the eye of the beholder.
I appreciate your writing, so I do call it high quality.
Thank you, I appreciate that.
But I appreciate your reportage on the Biden matter for this program even more. So I'll leave the floor to you, and please let us know what's going on with Joe Biden.
Well, he's in the race, as everybody figured. It seemed like an on-again, off-again thing he was going to announce. Then he wasn't, and then he postponed it. It originally was going to be in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
Symbolic for
Joe Biden's progressivism.
On Wednesday. But he eschewed going to Charlottesville. But it's obvious in watching, or in this case, hearing his announcement video, why he had Charlottesville in mind. Because Scott, when he announced today, it was a singular attack on President Trump as a white supremacist, a racist, someone who
really?
went.
So just to clear,
that
so
was
just
the whole video.
So let me just
it was the whole video.
Let me just announce to people, we're recording this. It is about 4:45 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time on Thursday. And you were surprised when we first started that I hadn't seen this video. And I have purposely stayed away from Biden news just to hear it from you. So, yeah, I'll hear it for the first time.
All right. So he starts out with a lot of flag waving, quoting the Constitution, all the stuff that most presidential candidates do. And then he immediately goes into a diatribe about what happened at Charlottesville. This was the whole video, and here's pretty much all you have to hear.
Charlottesville is also home to a defining moment for this nation in the last few years.
You will not replace us!
It was there in August of 2017 we saw Klansmen and white supremacists and neo-Nazis come out in the open. Their crazed faces, illuminated by torches, veins bulging, and bearing the fangs of racism. And that's when we heard the words of the President of the United States that stunned the world and shocked the conscience of this nation.
Yep.
He said there were, quote, some very fine people on both sides.
Mm-hmm. That's what he said.
God.
Now, listen, Scott. That is such a gross distortion of what, Trump said.
Every other week I play these two clips. I'm going to play them right now. Here is Trump, and this is what he said about the people in Charlottesville who were there because they thought it was not unreasonable, that it was okay to maybe leave up these statuaries as a—
That had been there for over a century.
It doesn't matter that their rationale for wanting to leave them up wasn't racism, and Trump says so.
But— That isn't what was reported. That isn't what will ever be reported. And okay,
well, let's just take a listen to that clip right now. Hold on here. Hold on 1 second.
These are all the remarks that you need to hear.
But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides. You had people in that group. Excuse me. I saw the same pictures as you did. You had people in that group that were there to protest the taking down of, to them, a very, very important statue and the renaming of a park from Robert E. Lee to another name.
And if anybody wasn't sure exactly what he was talking about, Tim, in the same presser, he then clarifies, just in case there's any debate about whether he's talking about white supremacists, and here's what he says.
You're changing history, you're changing culture, and you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay? And the press has treated them absolutely unfairly. Now, in the other group also, you had some fine people.
So, we know for sure that Donald Trump has said one thing only, and it's I hate to have to keep saying it, but the DNC chair, I think it was 2 weeks ago, said it on either Meet the Press, is... All Trump is saying is that you can be a good person and think those statues should be taken down, and you can be a good person and think they should stay up, and not have anything to do with being a racist or a white supremacist or anything like that.
I think that it's clear now that unlike the other presidential candidates, the other 20 that are in the race, that are at least giving lip service to the idea of running a campaign on something more than just despising Trump the most—
mm-hmm.
That Joe Biden is apparently basing his whole campaign on not Trump. He's not Trump, and that will be enough for him because the whole video was consumed with Trump's hatred. The whole video was about Trump.
Not only that, Tim, but this is what Joe Biden's saying. If you support Donald Trump,
you are a racist.
You're half a step away if you're not an actual racist.
I don't even know if you're half a step away.
So
this isn't, look, this is
a straight progressive attack, by the way. And he was going to be, I thought, from what I heard on the...
The moderate.
He was going to be the unprogressive candidate. He was going to be the adult in the room who didn't think we could rebuild every building in the universe inside of 12 years and stop...
Well, this is his play for the progressive vote, obviously, because you have to play for that in the far left crazed environment that the Democratic presidential candidates are running in with one radical idea after another. Like this week, we had Bernie Sanders, who thinks people in prison, including the Boston Marathon bomber, should be allowed to vote.
AOC's chief of staff, whose name I can't recall right now, he's very active on Twitter, and he tweeted also that the right to vote is mentioned several times in our Constitution.
Right.
It's a fundamental right, and the best reply I saw to him was, so is the right to keep and bear arms. Do you think the guy should be able to have a gun inside a prison?
Well, you give up all kind of rights.
Of course you do.
When you go to prison.
That's the point of prison, is to strip you of your rights, actually. Which
exactly.
Is one of the reasons why I think, Tim, we should be putting fewer people in prison rather than more people. But that's not what AOC and Bernie want. They want more laws and more people to go to prison.
But this is the climate that Biden now enters. And this is his play for saying he's just as progressive as the rest of them. In fact, he's more progressive because he's been progressive for 40 years, when in fact he's been a corporatist from beginning to end, from to the very core of his being, as
Excuse
you have
me,
so rightly
when he,
pointed
when
out.
When he wasn't being a hardcore drug warrior, by the way.
A drug warrior, yeah. Too. Absolutely. But this is
authoring,
look, this is
authoring, not just a drug warrior in terms of rah, rah, let's do it, but authoring the crime bill that made so many inner city blacks have to spend time in prison that they wouldn't have otherwise.
This is a naked play for the black vote.
Whoa, don't say naked around Uncle Joe,
that's
Tim.
That's true. Trouble there. Trouble on the horizon. That's one of the, I concluded my article, Scott, by saying there's so many problems with Joe Biden that he could spend the entirety of his presidential campaign explaining them all away. Mm-hmm. You've got the problem with Ukraine and the fact that his son was given $166,000, $166,000 a month for to serve as a vice president for business he didn't know anything out. And then they suppressed the investigation by having...
Let's just slow that down just for a second, Tim, okay? Because I don't think that everybody knows about it.
Well, I'm
Joe
trying
Biden's
to explain it.
Joe Biden's son, who had no experience at all in oil... He's like you and I. He watched J.R. Ewing when he was a kid, right? Like his. And we lost. What's his name today? By the way, Cliff Barnes. Unfortunately, rest in peace.
Oh, is that right?
Yes, we did.
I'm sorry to hear that.
But
Ken Kershaval, I believe, was his name.
Fantastic.
That's very good.
Yes. He didn't know anything about the oil business. Had no previous experience in the oil business, and all of a sudden, people with massive. Interest that could be positively affected by a kind word from a vice president of the United States hired his kid for a huge salary to go live and work in Ukraine. It would be like be like literally hiring me to go do that.
But that that wasn't even the worst part of it. The worst part was that the company he worked for came under investigation for racketeering and money laundering, and the Obama administration, what they did was threatened to remove loan guarantees to Ukraine unless this chief prosecutor was fired. And then he was fired, and it's Biden's good. Son, Hunter, kept his job. That's one thing, okay?
It's good to be friends with the king, right?
And on top of that, look at his failed presidential – it's embarrassing – performance in two previous presidential campaigns. Got in 1988, he had to pull out because he plagiarized a speech from Neil Kinnock, a British politician, and he was called out on it. And then they revealed that he had cheated in law school. He plagiarized at Syracuse University Law School. He'd plagiarized something from a law review journal, and he barely escaped expulsion at that point. So you've got that problem. In 2008, he ran for president. He didn't even achieve 1% in the first contest, the Iowa caucuses, and he pulled out immediately. So what is it this time that he thinks is going to appeal to Democrat voters that he couldn't get them to understand the first two times he ran?
You know, he may have a point in terms of if you can just get ahead of this. He's got the great name recognition in terms of being the immediate past vice president of the United States.
Another excuse to use that term.
So that, you know, there's the power of incumbency for the free press, and his power in that regard doesn't come from incumbency, but immediate past incumbency, and it is big in terms of, you know, there's a guy who I'm actually going to produce a segment for later on in the uprising, later on. Before the show gets released, and I forget his name. He's a congressman from California, and I made a note to talk about his introduction into the race, but I don't even remember his name. I know Joe Biden's name, Tim, and so do most Americans because of that history.
And that's the only reason.
Some brand that has some power. So if he can stay ahead, hear my point. If he can actually get a nose ahead of these other folks because of that brand recognition, maybe anybody could win against Trump, meaning. Because Trump has been so demonized and denigrated by the legacy media for so long, right? I mean, it's a daily show.
Not Trump can beat Trump.
Not any, but almost any. We know that Hillary is just a step too far. But maybe Biden is Hillary light enough that his corruption is only mild compared to hers.
All right, but name recognition. Hillary Clinton had about 95% name recognition going into the 2016 race. That actually hurt her. Biden's name recognition is high, but as soon as he gets in the race, they're going to start attacking him. And he has not shown the ability really to respond in an effective
way. He's a buffoon.
He is a buffoon.
I mean, that's fair to say.
He's a total buffoon. It's hard to believe that this guy is the front runner.
It's bonkers, insane. When Obama picked him to be his... I think we had a conversation about it.
There was no reason for it. What the hell are you doing?
It doesn't make any sense.
It's like just picking some generic corporatist white guy to sort of balance the ticket.
Now, let's also talk
a little bit before we end this overly long segment.
Tim, I am the producer of the Uprising podcast, and I'm here to tell
you it is not overly long. We're hearing a lot of positive response
of the interaction, by the way, on the Biden segment. You're getting a lot of praise
out there. Oh, good, good, good.
Absolutely.
Well, glad to hear it. Well, let's talk about this one then, because I think people will like this. And this is Joe Biden's apology tour, which he has done leading up to this big day when he makes his announcement calling Trump a racist.
Has he apologized for parading naked in front of the Secret Service women who are...
Not as of yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did he apologize for... pulling levers of power that others of us couldn't pull to get his kid a plum spot in the Navy that he then showed up high on cocaine? Or is that something that wasn't included
in this? I think he's working on a response to
that. Just checking.
But here's the apology tour.
Go ahead.
Okay, it's an unofficial apology tour, sort of like Obama's, except Obama was apologizing for the United States when he made his world apology tour. Biden's apologizing for himself. Now, the first part of that was when he had the temerity about, what, 6-8 weeks ago, had the temerity to call Vice President Mike Pence a decent guy.
Mm-hmm.
An LGBTQ, LGBT, I got it right, LGBTQ, one LGBTQ activist tweeted out that it was a disgrace because Pence was anti-gay.
Mm-hmm.
Biden apologized on Twitter an hour later. Now, there's a profile in political courage for you, Scott. Yeah. He apologizes for calling a decent guy a decent guy. But wait, that's not all. Then he went back to the Anita Hill hearing and said, I wish there was something I could have done to assist Anita Hill. Not perhaps cognizant was of the fact that he was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
There's so,
wishes that then...
That's a good line, by the way, for people who don't know that fact.
I wish I could have done something.
No, in other words, for some universe of people, it's like, well, he does wish he, you know.
Yeah, he wishes. Yeah, that's, right. That's good. But here was the most overt act of pandering I've seen in a long time.
Uh-huh.
And this was after he talked about Anita Hill. He said it's all because of the white guy culture.
Right.
And he said in his most profound voice, that's got to change. That's
why
got
we
to
have
change.
To elect Joe Biden. And as I believe our first first doctor as first lady, Jill Biden, elevate them to the White House. And that's when this tyranny of whiteness will end.
But I mean, he decries the white guy's culture. Yeah. Apparently thinking no one will notice that he's like the poster child for the corporatist white guy culture that he's attacking. And then, of course, there was the apology for the six people who publicly came forward to say the women who were victims of unwanted touching. And in that one, and we discussed this, he said, Eskimo kisses by Uncle Joe. He understands that social norms have changed. Translation, Scott, it was okay for me to paw these women then, but now in the Me Too movement, culture, I understand, I won't do it anymore.
I won't pinch any butts.
But he didn't say it was wrong or that he regrets it, only that social norms have changed. So there's Joe Biden's apology tour, Scott.
I wonder if they'll let him get away with it. And I think it's interesting to see how these various media properties, because they all have their horses in the race, right?
Exactly.
I'm going to play later on this MSNBC clip with the aforementioned congressional member who's running for president from California, and his performance on MSNBC, and he's clearly not their choice. So it's like when they're critical of a Democrat, especially if they're critical in a way that you might see from a right-wing publication, you know, what are the criticisms that they're using, or if they attack them from the left,
Now, you're not planning to attack Eric Swalwell.
That's who I'm talking about. Yeah, Eric Swalwell.
But he wants to stop violence, gun violence against kids in schools. Scott, how can you be against
that? Common sense, Tim. Common sense.
Well, let me tell you something, though. When it comes to Biden, the long knives are already out for him. From the other 20 candidates.
Has there been one who stood out as an effective attacker?
Not enough time has passed yet from when he announced to this
recording. In a campaign season where so many on that side of the aisle, and I think I'll close out with this, Tim, not that, you know, I'm not criticizing you for not bringing it up because you're above it, all right? I'm not, though, which is that if you want to make fun of a candidate's hair, go ahead, everybody, and do a Google image search on Joe Biden's hair.
Oh, the plugs.
And enjoy yourself a laugh.
Do you feel, Scott, that Biden's plugs were done effectively, or would you have
effectively for a human? If you're actually trying to replicate a doll's head, then yes, he's got.
Okay. Right.
And by the way, it's not appropriate. Meaning, like, if Joe Biden had good policies, I wouldn't care what his hair looks like. I don't care. It's a laugh line a little bit, but the way it's focused on with Trump, with his physical visage, and there are attacks on him. Do you remember the naked statue they put up, the like three of them in New York that made fun of his thing?
Yes.
You know, again, these are the people who say body shaming is verboten and you can't do it. But unless, of course, it's somebody who you disagree with politically.
Well, Scott, all rules are off when it comes to Trump. All rules are suspended because this is a unique situation requiring unique actions
democracy
to take
in danger,
down.
Tim. Yes. Democracy dies in darkness.
It dies in darkness, Scott.
Joe Biden, for president, reporter for the Uprising podcast, Tim Donner, thank you so much for joining us.
And I'm looking forward to many more of these sessions, Scott. They're a guilty pleasure.
Tim and I recorded that on Thursday. On Friday, when he was flying out to the NRA convention, Donald Trump again directly addressed the issue of his statement in Charlottesville that there were good people on both sides. Here is the very latest. From Friday, April 26. In case you can't hear the question as it's shouted over the helicopter blades, it is this. Mr. President, do you still think there were very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville?
President, do you still think there were very fine people on both sides in Charlottesville?
Well, I've answered that question, and if you look at what I said, you will see that that question was answered perfectly. And I was talking about people that went because they felt very strongly about the monument to Robert E. Lee, a great general. Whether you like it or not, he was one of the great generals. I've spoken to many generals here, right at the White House, and many people thought of the generals. They think that he was maybe their favorite general. People were there protesting the taking down of the monument of Robert E. Lee. Everybody knows that.
So not only was the question answered, but it was answered perfectly. Oh boy, that guy is a laugh riot. But once again, will the left stop lying about his answer? It's not a mistake anymore, right? I mean, the facts are out there. If you say Trump was saluting racists and white supremacists and saying there are good people who are members of those two groups or ideologies, you're lying, and it's a pretty disgusting lie. At some point, that sort of lie can do a lasting damage to this country, and I hope that legacy media members, when these people appear on their programs, hold their feet to the fire. They shouldn't be able to pick at America's scabs for their own political benefit with impunity. Trump was also asked something about how old was too old to be president, and had this comment about the respective ages of him and immediate past Vice President Biden.
Well, I think that I just feel like a young man. I'm so young. I can't believe it. I'm the youngest person. I am a young, vibrant man. I look at Joe. I don't know about him. I don't know.
I'll tell you, you know, if nothing, he makes it fun. We have to salute the Trump for that. He also made it fun for a little bit at the NRA convention when he kick John McCain in the grave just a little bit. And we'll get into that in a second. But before we do talk about Trump's speech and his reception at the NRA convention, let's talk about the major battle for the keys of the kingdom in terms of the NRA. The NRA has been ruled for, gosh, maybe 30 years, at least 20 years, by Wayne LaPierre. He is the executive vice president of that organization. And for at least that long, that's where the power rests. Charlton Heston was made president of the NRA a while ago. And before that, the president may have had some actual power, but for a very long time, the head of the organization has been Wayne LaPierre. The current president of the NRA is Oliver North. There is a power kind of battle between the LaPierre people and the Oliver North people, and it concerns this company called Ackerman McQueen, which is called their longtime marketing and PR firm. It's a vendor that the NRA has paid oceans of money to over the years, and they have a financial relationship with Oliver North. So Oliver North is like a paid presenter or whatever for that Ackerman McQueen group. And there's also talk of questions surrounding the fidelity to all the laws that allow the NRA to maintain its tax-exempt status for its main group. It's chartered in New York State. And one thing we know about New York State officials is that they are more than happy to use the powers and levers of government to punish their political enemies. So we can expect a full court press from everybody in New York to try to shut down the NRA if they can. So some board members went to LaPierre with sort of the North contingent and demanded his resignation. Not only did Mr. LaPierre not resign, but he also published a open letter to the members of the board where he called the behavior in the parlance of extortionists, that he was offered an offer he couldn't refuse, and that basically the proponents of the offers threatened to write a lot of nasty, untrue stuff about him and financial impropriety, all concerning Ackerman McQueen and the money that they get paid. Now, firstly, full disclosure, I am an NRA member and certified firearms instructor. So how I come down on this in terms of the leadership of the organization as a member of that organization is a pox on both their houses. This is about money. What Oliver North is getting paid by these people, and you know, Wayne LaPierre has turned his gig into, he's fantastically wealthy. I think he makes over $1 million a year, and he's got all these lucrative consulting arrangements, if you believe the critics, and I do generally believe them. But in any case, the focus here has not been on securing gun rights for Americans now and in the future, where it should be. And part of the problem is that we've become so tribalized that positions have been so calcified that you can't have a Democrat who supports broadening gun rights, it seems like. In fact, there was an op-ed in USA Today published by Peter Funt, of all people. Yes, that Peter Funt. Mr. Funt's position that USA Today thought was important enough to give in their limited real estate, said that Kamala Harris, because she owns a handgun, apparently thinks it's fine to own a handgun for personal safety, quote, which he insisted was a position held by the NRA, not progressive Democrats, and that it's an underpublicized revelation. Her words are fine but not for progressives like me. They're undermined by that handgun. So you can't be a Democrat president of the United States if you own a handgun, under his view. And I think it's bad news for the gun rights community, really, that we have to sort of buy into Republicans only. Not that I'm saying it's a viable option to vote for any Democrats when we know how hostile they do seem to be to gun rights, Kamala Harris included, and we will get to her in a minute. But the problem is, and the reason why I bring it up is, Donald Trump went to the NRA convention and he got a great introduction. So long and fawning, I can't even play it for you here. And he did so on the 1 month anniversary of this disgusting anti-liberty bump stock ban. And if you haven't tuned into that, it's quite simple. A bump stock is a device that people use. They install a firearm onto it, and it allows them in some instances to produce a rapid fire machine gun like spraying of bullets. And it's not a precision device, and they don't work terribly well. I've had some limited experience. I don't own one. Thankfully, I wasn't one of the people who lost one when they were banned or made a felon, because that was your choice. What happens is, if you want to develop some gun accessory or part, it's very confusing, even for people in the industry, to know exactly what runs afoul of the law and what is allowed. It's a hyper-technical designation and also a political one, depending on who sort of the decision-maker involved. So what happens is, you want to make a device that helps people shoot faster bullets because that's what the market will support. Well, what do? You send your device into the ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The technology branch will evaluate it, and they send you a letter. And the letter says, hey, you're good to go. This is not an impermissible firearm or somehow violative of the law. And then you get to sell your product and not run the risk of getting thrown in a cage for it, right? Well, then all of a sudden, one day, President Trump comes along and bows to political pressure. And let's be honest, serious shooters, people who are firearms enthusiasts, most of us don't use bump stocks. We consider them to be junk or I don't know, day class A something, but they're not for serious shooters for the most part. Most gun owners probably never even heard of them before the Las Vegas shootings when Mr. Hatfield was, I think, accused of using bump stocks in that massacre. So you fast forward and Trump figures it's a political, it's a hit he can take. There's not that many out there in existence anyway. It's no big deal. Well, it is a big deal if you're supposed to be the organization that stands up for gun owners and gun rights. And more importantly, how about for due process for gun owners? There's no escape valve in the law for ignorance. Plenty of people, I'm sure most of the people who bought these devices don't follow gun rights law as part of their job. If they don't come across it, then they don't come across it. And they're automatically felons for having these devices that they bought that were perfectly legal when they bought. And it'd be one thing if there was a law that was passed to make them illegal, but it wasn't. It was just Donald Trump and the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms branch just changing a code of federal regulations. It's a perfect opportunity to stand up to Donald Trump and say, you are not doing the right thing for gun owners, and hold his feet to the fire. Anytime these groups are fawning over elected officials, it's almost always a bad idea. And this fawning over Trump, because he is, of course, light years better than a President Hillary Clinton would have been, or a President Kamala Harris will be. No. That's not okay. Hold his feet to the fire. You don't have to throw him out and cast him aside and say you won't support him or that he's bad for gun rights. But to not mention a month afterward that with the stroke of his pen, he committed this body blow against due process and liberty, especially for gun owners. Well, like I say, a pox on all their houses. Well, let's listen a little bit into Donald Trump's speech to the assembled at the NRA National Convention in Indianapolis.
In 2 years, we did more to regulation. Think of that, than any president in the history of our country. It's one of the reasons our jobs are booming, one of the reasons the economy is booming. We gave you the largest tax cut in the history of our country, the biggest ever. And we got Anwar approved, and we got the individual mandate, the absolute worst part of Obamacare, eliminated. Now we're going for the rest. And we had it done except for one vote. You know what I'm talking about. One vote.
The gall that he has to put forth his deregulation record before the audience against whom he enacted his most heinous regulation. The worst possible thing he did in his presidency was to sign a piece of paper that allows for the imprisoning of our fellow Americans for doing literally nothing wrong, and he's touting it. But anyway, I left it. I had to put it in there because I love the dig at McCain. He just can't. He just can't let it go. And well, I love him for that, if nothing else. Okay, let's turn our attention to some other candidates, namely the junior senator from California, Kamala Harris, who is making guns and gun control a centerpiece of her campaign for president. Here she is at a town hall meeting.
As president, how will you go about keeping our schools safe and keeping guns out of the hands of those who should not have them?
Thank you, Ben. And I'm sure that there are plenty of students here who, while you were in high school, even middle school, that you had to participate in a drill, right? Where you were convened and your teachers taught you about how you need to go and run in a closet because there may be a mass shooter roaming the hallways of your school. And in our America, that should never have to happen. Conversations take place.
Well, let me just pause the audio to add my applause. What courage that it took her to stand up and make that claim that Americans should not have to suffer from mass casualties in their children's schools. Wow. Well, after the lecture, we learned some more about what Kamala Harris's plans actually are for fixing these ills with respect to our guns in America.
I will give the United States Congress 100 days to get their act together and have the courage to pass reasonable gun safety laws. And if they fail to do it, then I will take executive action. And specifically what I will do is put in place a requirement that for anyone who sells more than 5 guns a year, they are required to do background checks when they sell those guns. I will require that for any gun dealer that breaks the law, the ATF take their license. And by the way, ATF, alcohol, tobacco, and firearms. Well, the ATF has been doing a lot of the A and the T, but not much of the F. And we need to fix that. And then...
I think that her laughing at that lame-ass joke that she made is disqualifying for her to get the nomination. Well, let me just tackle a couple of those things before we allow her to continue in terms of why those aren't common sense gun regulations from the perspective of gun rights advocates. When we, for instance, hear someone like her say, if a gun dealer breaks the law, that she's going to have the ATF revoke their license, that may seem like a rational response. Like, well, sure, if we can't have gun dealers out there breaking the law, that's probably how horrible criminals get their guns. And if that were the case, if that were the laws they were talking about, like if there's a gun dealer who's taking his inventory down to the hood at night and selling it from the back of a Buick for cash on the barrelhead, then yes, that would make sense to take their licenses away. But what we fear is that the hyper-regulatory state involves basically it's sort of like you can't drive a car without breaking a traffic law. If you don't know that, that's sort of how it works. There are so many laws that if you drive for any distance, you're going to break some traffic law. It's one of the ways that the police use to sort of pull people over who they want to. They just follow for long enough time, and if they have a thorough enough knowledge of the traffic laws, they're confident they're going to be able to make that stop. Well, the same idea applies here. Our fear is that when Kamala Harris runs the ATF, she'll basically say that if you forgot to put a period in this column instead of the other column, or if you used, instead of saying it's April 27th, 2019, if you said it was 4/27/2019, that kind of a thing, that's going to result in revocations of licenses, because that's the kind of games we've seen before from elected representatives, namely leftist elected representatives, although not exclusively, but especially, who wish to use the powers and levers of the administrative state to punish their political enemies and reward their friends politically, and implement their policy goals outside of the legislative process. And given the past, I don't think that they can say that's an unreasonable concern on our part.
On the third piece, because none of us have been sleeping over the last 2 years, part of what has happened under the current administration is they took fugitives off the list of prohibited people. I put them back on the list, meaning that fugitives from justice should not be able to purchase a handgun or any kind of weapon. So that's what I do.
Now, when I heard Senator Harris say this, I must admit to being a little perplexed. I don't consider the fugitive groups to be any kind of a key constituency in the gun rights community. I hadn't heard that President Trump, making some rule or any new law passed to allow fugitives to buy guns. So what is this about? Well, let's turn our attention not to Breitbart.com or Fox News, but let's turn our attention to the Washington Post to learn about this story. They write in 2017, the headline is "Tens of Thousands with Outstanding Warrants Purged from Background Check Database for Gun Purchases." And what I learn when I read that story is that for more than 15 years, the FBI and ATF disagreed about who was a fugitive from justice. They both run criminal background check databases, and there has to be sort of some agreement about what these terms mean so that those background checks can flow smoothly, and so that all the various reporting agencies, state police agencies, and so on, basically have a standardized understanding as to what is what, right? That's how you can determine if somebody is, in fact, a fugitive. We have to agree on what that is. So in a 2016 report for the Obama, Holder had resigned in disgrace by then, and it was the Obama Lynch Justice Department, Inspector General Michael Horowitz urged the Justice Department to address the disagreement, quote, as soon as possible, because the FBI had run, had a broad definition that said anyone with an outstanding arrest warrant was prohibited from buying a gun. But the ATF had argued, again, the Obama ATF argued that under the law, a person was considered a fugitive only if they had an outstanding warrant and tried to leave to go to another state. Well, guess what? Before President Trump took office, the Justice Department Office of Legal Counsel sided with the ATF and narrowed the definition of fugitives. So the Obama Justice Department and the Obama ATF agreed that it was a question that was important that needed to be settled, and they agreed on what the right ruling was. The ruling was put into place to be changed after President Trump is inaugurated. He doesn't stand in the way of what these professionals at the Justice Department under President Obama had put into place. And now he's supposed to, what, get a political hit from Kamala Harris for somehow allowing fugitives to buy guns? No, that is fake news. Not to be outdone in the race to the progressive voting bloc, we have Mr. Swalwell. He's going to take all our guns. Eric Swalwell is a congressman from California. His district is just outside of Oakland. He's a young guy for running for president anyway. I think he's 38 years old, and gun rights or removing gun rights is right at the top of his agenda items for leading America.
Gun violence is something you're hammering as a concern. How do you fix it? And is that an issue that you think actually distinguishes you in the Democratic primary? Or is that something you guys are all agreement on?
I'm going to be the champion to end gun violence. And in my first 100 days, I'm going to ask Congress to pass background checks. We did that in the House already. We need the Senate to actually force a vote now. I'm going to ban and buy back 15 million assault weapons. And I know most Americans are with me. We saw it done in Australia. It was just done in New Zealand. That'll reduce the victims in mass shootings. Take the most dangerous weapons from the most dangerous people. And invest in gang violence prevention programs in the cities where you have victims whose names we never hear and stories we are never told. It just takes leadership, Ari. And what I've found, I think I've cracked the code with the NRA. They are a vocal, tweeting, bullying minority. And most people, the moms and the students and the parents, they want sensible gun violence laws. They're with us. We just need a leadership in the White House to do that.
Well, he's right on one fact, but I think he's wrong on an analysis point there, and it may come back to bite him, which is that he's right that the majority of people do support these gun control measures. Now, I don't think they're common sense gun control measures, and I think that support comes out of a fundamental ignorance that they will actually improve conditions vis-a-vis violence in America, which I think the data clearly indicates is not there. The assault weapons ban of 1994 did not reduce murders in this country. It didn't do anything except for drive up the prices for those guns. And a massive sales opportunity, of course. The number of those guns in production just went up insanely because the forbidden fruit aspect. But those support levels he talks about are probably true. Here's the thing. Very few numbers of people will vote yes no matter what for a candidate who supports gun control. Said another way, a single issue voter on the anti-gun side. That is a rarer bird by far than a single gun issue on the pro-gun side. It's a difference between support that is broad and shallow and more narrow and very deep. And the reason why that deep support gets catered to rather than the shallow support is because when the going gets tough, the shallow support wanes. But the deep support is there. George Herbert Walker Bush credited his defeat for his reelection bid due to his support for increased gun controls and the NRA mobilizing against him, or gun owners mobilizing against him. Bill Clinton said that the NRA is the reason why the 104th Congress was elected. That is the 1994 revolution that kicked out the longstanding Democrat majority to initiate a Republican majority in Newt Gingrich. Well, that was thanks to gun owners. I haven't even talked about the more inflammatory, it boggles the mind. He says he's going to ban 15 million assault rifles. That means that 15 million assault rifles that are in private hands in America, he's going to confiscate. I love the buy back language, by the way. Well, they were never owned by the government in the first place. They've always been private property. So you're not buying anything back. You're just confiscating something or taking. You're stealing it if you don't give payment. But if the government takes something for the public good and then compensates the owner, that is a taking, and they have to compensate them. Well, leaving aside for a second the fact that some significant minority of gun owners are going to want to kill the people who come to take their firearms, and likely that will result in some significant loss of life, let's just put that aside. And let's just talk about 15 million, some other inanimate objects that don't have the political heat that guns do. Let's just call it, let's say pepper mills. Let's say there are 15 million pepper mills in circulation in private homes in America, and the federal government's going to confiscate them all for whatever reason. What do you think the level of pepper mills that they're going to get is? Do you think they're going to get close to the actual 15 million? Or do you think that maybe there's going to be a sufficient number out there that a motivated individual could get their hands on a pepper mill? Well, now let's make it guns. Is it really going to prohibit the motivated murderer from getting an assault weapon? You know, we don't have a big problem with like spree killing where they woke up and bought a gun and just decided to start shooting. No, the problem we have is with these premeditated massacres. And is there any reason to believe that given all the planning that takes place, that those people wouldn't be able to get an actual firearm? Don't you believe it. And don't give up your rights so easily. They're hard won, and they'll be hard to win back. Well, that just about does it. I had one clip that I just thought was too precious not to play you, and that's the fine folks at NBC News and the nation's leader in political talk, the Meet the Press show, and its host, Chuck Todd. And what did they learn? What was the big takeaway? Let's pause and reflect and leave us with something moment from the Mueller report and the investigation itself.
One item worth noting before we go to break. The Mueller report validates most, not all, but most of the reporting done by major news organizations throughout this investigation. Many, many of the stories we were told that were fake news show up as reported in the Mueller report and confirmed by firsthand accounts. It's something worth considering the next time you hear someone use the phrase fake news so loosely.
Somehow he manages to turn that arm right around and pat himself on the back. Beyond parody as far as this viewer is concerned. Thank you so much for joining us. Hopefully you'll catch up with us next week too. Visit libertynation.com 24/7, 365 for that sweet, sweet conservatarian news and analysis. Thanks. Bye-bye.